And I think you're bringing up a really important point, Karen, is the way that a lot of these organizations operate is through implication of an intimidation, that if these people are implicated in this criminal activity, they're drawn in, and they can be drawn in and blackmailed, as you say, under influence of drugs or under other kinds of influences.
Exactly.
And this, of course, has profound implications for our society, where, you know, we're supposed to be electing public officials and being representatives of the public. But really, you know, how healthy of a system can that be when you've got this these layers of blackmail happening right up the hierarchy, it seems.
But it's always been this way. You know, the stories that I was told about, that, for example, the Dionysian sect, the oldest laws that were ever passed against ritual abuse happened in Rome pre-Christ, and they were made against the very Dionysian sects that were still in operation in the 40s and 50s, which I'm assuming are still in operation now. And the reason the laws were made against them was not because at that time, you know, there were citizens and then there were people who were not citizens. And it was known that in the rituals there were sexual orgies, there was flaying, which is skinning of people, there was flagellation, there was abuse of, you know, ritual rape of women and children. That isn't why there were laws made against the groups, though. The laws were made against the groups because of the practice of common commission of crime for the purpose of political blackmail.
655 or 595-1477.
KLN, as we celebrate African Liberation Month with Spiritual Resistance for the Soul.
And we're back with Karen Stardancer and Gail Fisher-Taylor here on a panel discussion on ritual abuse as part of the radio series on mind control here at the International Connection. I'd like to focus now on survivor issues and what your both experiences are in terms of resources available for survivors and how that's been changing over, the last 10 years or so.
Well, compared to when I was in recovery, there are a lot of resources and a lot of information. However, when we first started making that recovery information available, it was a lot better climate. Now there's the backlash, and the backlash is having a very chilling effect on the availability of services in that even a therapist who treats a survivor is running risk at this point of suit under the guise of quote-unquote alleged false memory. And so it's really difficult at this point, although there are still resources available. As I said, survivorship has members all over the place, and we provide as much information as possible, and there are still people willing to take the risk of doing treatment and giving information.
And I'd like to say, actually, that an excellent resource is survivorship, which Karen is running. A lot of people I work with have found it, and I find it to be a really excellent resource. So I'm wondering, Karen, also, if you could give information about how to get survivorship, because I think it's one of the best sources of information that's available today.
Thank you. That's great. survivorship, we have an address in San Francisco, which is 3181 Mission Street, number 139, San Francisco, California, 94110. We also have email at survivorship@bigfoot.com, and we have a website for people who have internet access, which can give you a taste of what we have available, which is at www.ctsserver, that's one word, .com/tildesvship. And I know that's kind of tricky, so you can just run a search on one of the search engines with survivorship and you should be able to find us.
Can you describe what kind of issues you deal with and what survivorship typically deals with in an issue?
Well, where our focus is the use of belief systems and abuse together, you know, that a belief system used to abuse people. So our members are everyone from who has political torture, ritualistic torture, religious torture, mind control, government mind control. I mean, basically, it's across the board because our focus is to help people get out of a conditioned response, a traumatic conditioned response lifestyle. And as far as the way we address it, you know, we have a nonprofit. We're a nonprofit organization, and not only doesn't anybody make any money, we're barely surviving, but we keep going. We have a real eclectic kind of approach because of this, so that we talk about politics, we talk about recovery, we talk about personal experience, we allow people the ability to do their art and their writing, and as well we have sections for teens, Gen X, family members, partners, children survivors, and children of survivors. So we basically take as broad approach as we possibly can, because essentially healing this type of abuse impacts every aspect of a person's humanity. So basically you have to address every aspect of that person in order to have healing. And healing is what we're really interested in. Freedom, people getting a experience of free will back, a quality of life that they may never have known.
Now, just to put out the telephone number again, we are taking phone calls here from our listeners at 595-1477 and 595-1655. And did you have something to add? Yep.
Well, I just wanted to go back to something that that you were talking about, Karen, a little bit earlier, which was the effect of the backlash. And I think, fortunately, the litigation in Canada has not gone so berserk as it has in the States. It's in terms of litigation, Canada tends to be more conservative, and there are fortunately, for survivors, more barriers to the litigation. Although I do think it's on the increase, and it will. I mean, we tend to be often about 10 years behind the U.S. Although in litigation, let's hope that that's not the case. But I would say that the backlash has had a tremendous effect. It has had an impact on therapists who are treating survivors, and it certainly has had an impact on survivors who are recalling this kind of abuse and not wanting, you know, as they uncover what's happened to them in their traumatic past, and they have a certain kind of resistance that's protective to wanting to believe this themselves. So when the environment is feeding back to them that this doesn't exist or can't exist, and there's all the kind of false memory propaganda, as I like to call it, that's in the atmosphere and in the media, very prevalent in the media, I think it has quite a harmful impact on survivors.
Devastating effect.
Yes. But I think, on the other hand, with one of the things that's happening with survivors is that when they're able to network, when they're able to get good information, such as the information that's available in survivorship, that there's a strengthening that occurs against the backlash as well. And I know a number of very strong survivors speaking out against the False Memory Foundation. As I've said before on this program, I refuse to call it syndrome.
And the wonderful thing about global communication at this point is now the door is open and it can't be shut. Throughout history, when the door's been opened before, it's been pretty easy to shut. I mean, essentially, you would have a few people talking and a few people could be easily silenced. And they had no way of knowing that there were a few people maybe in the next town or a few people in another country talking about the same thing. And you cannot silence us at this point. I just, it's not possible.
And I think also there are some legal cases where ritual abuse is involved, and certainly in Canada there have been some prosecutions where ritual abuse has been a component of the abuse that's been prosecuted successfully. We have a big case in Prescott, Ontario, where there have been signed confessions around ritualized activity.
I also think it's really fortunate that in Canada that you had some press coverage of some pretty notorious cases. I'm thinking of the, I can't remember where it was. Again, my
Montreal,
the cases of the religious abuse in the orphanages. And that was well publicized before the backlash. And so it isn't that difficult for people to go, wait a minute, though, this really happened. So when you have people coming along saying it doesn't happen, it isn't quite as effective.
I think that what's been really useful is when the cases are prosecuted on things like the pornography rings,
mm-hmm.
On the criminal activity that people know happens, and when those kinds of rings, the prostitution, child prostitution rings, and the child pornography rings, as well as those adult ones, but when they are broken and when there's investigation into them and successful prosecution, that really does help. I think there are more and more prosecutions, more and more investigations into those kinds of specific concentrations of criminal activity.
I think one of the things that's pretty instructive, though, is to see, for example, in the United States, I have seen in the same newspaper, practically side by side at times, news reports about cult activity, notoriously during the Branch Davidian disaster. There was another case with a small church torture that happened in the Bay Area, and at the same time, in the same paper, there would be false memory articles saying all of this is made up and it never happens. These things would be side by side and people still wouldn't see it.
Mm.
And the thing that's interesting to me is that these are people reading the papers who supposedly didn't even have mind control.
Yeah.
And
amazing.
They can't put, you know, the denial is so pervasive that to see the things side by side, you can still almost have a split mind about it, even not having a forced dissociative system.
Yeah, definitely. We are going to go to a caller now. We do have John on the phone. And John, are you there? Hello? We'll come right back to that. One question I did want to ask is, and I've been asked this, of people listening to this radio series and wondering about themselves, whether them having a look at their own lives and wondering if there has been any kinds of abuse that has occurred within their own childhood. How can, are there any suggestions that you can give with people with those kind of questions in their mind?
Well, I think that, this is one of those tricky areas that the false memory pounces on people who talk about these things. There are a lot of indicators that somebody has had an abusive history. Some of those indicators are, for instance, panic attacks. If somebody goes into a lot of panic attacks, and if within those panic attacks, they're getting basically flashbacks, which may not be recognized as such, of violence and sex and violence, or of people in black robes basically what they're getting is they're getting fragments of memory that have been dissociated suddenly surfacing. Certainly, dissociation indicates that there's been repeated trauma in somebody's life. So if somebody finds that they're spacing out a lot, in other words, that there are minutes, maybe hours, or maybe even days of time that they can't really fully account for, or they have very vague recollections, that this is an indication that there's been some sort of trauma in that person's life, and it's probably a useful thing to get some therapeutic help from someone who knows about dissociation. Certainly, there are other kinds of indicators. People who I've worked with have found strange things in their houses and apartments that they can't account for. And, I mean, it may be something like blood, for instance, or it may be that that someone left a glove behind, or someone left, and they don't know where these things came from. Now, this doesn't mean that ritual abuse took place specifically, but if there are a number of things that the person can't account for and is confused about, it's useful to start with help, I suggest, to try to understand what some of the explanations are for these things. I mean, there are many, many indicators that abuse has occurred, and I think it's a complex topic, and it's one, and it's part of the reason why it's so difficult to counter the false memory quick media bites, is because dissociation, traumatic memory, all of these things are quite a bit more complex and can't really be understood with a quick 5-second or even 5-minute explanation.
Okay, we do have a caller on the line now. We are going to go to that. John, are you there? Hello? No, we're still having technical difficulties. We'll try to bring that caller back on. No? This is Mr. Grant. Mr. Grant, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Yes, do you have a question or a comment for our panel?
I have a comment, which is from a book I bought in 1989 and read right through in 1990. I'll just read the blurb on the back. I think you'll get the picture. It's by Lolly Zamoyski, and it's called Behind the Facade of the Masonic Temple. Masonry and financial capital, masonry and the war machine, masonry and profit. When you lay bare such links, you always expose yourself to the risk that your opponents will charge you with simplification. But what will the reader say when he hears that the basic law of the Mason's central project is merely the law of profit, and also the establishment of a world economic government? Who said so? A Marxist? An anti-Masonic scribbler? Far from it. Those words came from Licio Gelli's friend and supporter and a member of the P2 Lodge, writer Pierre Capri. Pierre Capri explains that the point concerns placing society under the control of particular corporations which identify themselves with an economic power. At the same time, directly or indirectly, they're also identified with political power. This was published by Progress Publishers in 1989 in Moscow. If you remember, that was the year of the so-called collapse of communism. That's all I have to say. I agree with all the things I've just read.
Great. Well, thank you for your comments, Mr. Grant. I think you've raised an important point here in terms of we've been hearing allegations against the Masonic Lodge members, generally high-ranking members, and their historical positions of power in society have been quite formidable. We are going to go to another caller now. And caller, are you on the air?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and did you have a question or a comment for our panel?
It's more of a question. I have a close friend who is involved in the Eamon Society. Is anyone knowledgeable of that?
I'm not, no.
I'm not either. What can you tell us about it?
It's a group based in London, England, that's operating also here in Toronto, and the Society for Truth, supposedly. And their members donate $160 per month for the ability to go and hear dissertations on how the establishment is not the source of truth or the true establishment. And I was really just calling to get an authoritative view on that. If you're not knowledgeable about it, then Perhaps my question is misguided.
Yeah, I'm sorry we can't help. I don't know if Karen has heard of that group. That was, again, could you repeat the name of it?
Emin, E-M-I-N.
Okay. Karen, are you there?
I'm here, but I could barely hear. So I heard that there was an organization in England, but I didn't hear the name of it.
It was the Emin Society.
How is it
E-M-I-N.
Spelled?
E-M-I-N.
E-M-I-N. I haven't seen that one, no.
Yeah.
I see a lot of different things come across my desk, but that one I haven't particularly heard of. Sorry.
Okay, thanks. Do we have another caller? Okay. One other thing I wanted to touch on, and I don't know if either of you have dealt with this with the survivors that you've come in contact with, is what the importance of spiritual healing is to somebody that's undergone ritual abuse and really have been spiritually abused.
Well, my feeling is that all abuse impacts you spiritually. The vast majority of survivors that I've talked with and know feel that spiritual healing is one of the most important parts. However, there are some survivors who respond by saying, I really don't want to deal with this at all, having had this type of abuse. But statistically, most people feel that it's one of the most important parts of their healing, although it may be one of the later stages. It really depends on the person.
And I'd agree with that. I think it can be very frightening to deal with the spiritual abuse, and I think that spirituality has to be interpreted in a very broad sense. That a lot of survivors of ritual abuse who've been abused in an organized religious context are very afraid to get involved in certainly that aspect of spirituality, although there are many, many other ways that they find spiritual healing possible, often outside of the context of organized religion, and interpreting spirituality in a very broad and open kind of sense.
Now, we do have one final call in the panel discussion, and I believe Alex is on the line. Alex, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And did you have a question or comment for our panel?
Yes, I kind of wanted to go back to the caller about a few minutes who made the reference to masonry.
Yes.
And there's something I'd like to clarify about that whole position. I think it's important to point out that masonry, as it's popularly understood here in North America and throughout most of Europe, is not the masonry that previous gentleman was referring to. He was referring to a particular, like, Black Lodge type of masonry called the P2 in Italy. And I understand that there's also somewhat of a sinister lodge in France. But the masonry that's basically spread throughout the rest of the world, Grand Lodge or Blue Lodge masonry, has really nothing to do with mind control or cult activity or anything of that sort. So I think it's good to get that out there, because a lot of people might get a little bit confused and think that, well, maybe their uncle or their grandfather, even perhaps their father, was engaged in some sort of mind control practice, which is complete and utter rubbish.
Yeah, the reference to the P2 Lodge, Propaganda Due Lodge in Italy, is an illegal branch of the Masonic Lodge. And
Hold on. This is the point I'm trying to bring up, though. Masonry, as it's constituted in North America and throughout most of the world, falls under the jurisdiction of the Grand Lodge, which is in England, in the UK. Now, the lodges in France and the lodges in Italy have basically been blackballed by the Grand Lodge in England because of its nefarious activities. They are formal and separate organizations. It might be, perhaps, back in the 1750s that at one time they were all together under one roof. But for about the past 200 years, they have been separate organizations. And the masonry, like, for instance, the Masonic Temple down there on Yonge Street, you know the one I mean, that sort of masonry has nothing to do with the type of masonry that gets involved in all of these political intrigues.
Well, I'm afraid I'd have to disagree with you in the respect that we have heard from allegations from survivors across North America alleging that they have been abused in ritual abuse context or sexually abused by high-ranking Masons of the Scottish Rite and the York Rite of the mainstream Masonry. Now, that is not to say that all Masons are engaged in this kind of activity. In fact, I would think that the majority are not and have no knowledge of it. But we have heard allegation after allegation of high-ranking Masons and in these organizations that are engaged in this kind of activity.
Okay,
thank you for your comments, caller. I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up now. We're actually over time in our panel discussion, and I'd like to thank very much Karen Stardancer for joining us on the line and Gail Fisher-Taylor in the studios. Thank you both very much.
My pleasure.
And you've been listening to a panel discussion on ritual abuse here at CKLN, the International Connection, and we're just wrapping this up, and Key in Western America is coming up right after.
Sensitized to surprise, it seems like nothing could even fill me anymore.